My name is Patricia Kathleen, and this podcast series will contain interviews I conduct with female and female-identified entrepreneurs, founders, co-founders, business owners, and industry gurus. These podcasts speak with women and women-identified individuals across all industries in order to shed light for those just getting into the entrepreneurial game, as well as those deeply embedded within it. Histories, current companies, and lessons learned are explored in the conversations I have with these insightful and talented powerhouses. The series is designed to investigate a female and female-identified perspective in what has largely been a male-dominated industry in the USA to date. I look forward to contributing to the national dialogue about the long overdue change of women in American business arenas, and in particular, entrepreneurial roles. You can contact me via my media company website, wild.agency, that's wilde.agency, or my personal website, patriciakathleen.com. Thanks for listening. Now let's start the conversation. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. This is your host, Patricia, and today I am sitting down with Dr. Christina Chambers. She is a professor of pediatrics at the University of California, San Diego, and director of clinical research for the Department of Pediatrics at UCSD and Rady Children's Hospital. Welcome, Christina.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I should mention that Dr. Chambers is contacting us over Zoom today. We're just so excited that she took time at all out of her busy schedule. I wanted to read a quick bio on Dr. Chambers, as well as give you guys a roadmap for everyone listening regarding the structure of how today's chat will go so that you can refer back to it or skip ahead as need be. So quickly, a roadmap of today's podcast. We'll first introduce Christina's academic background and brief professional life. Then we'll drop straight into her current position at the Center for Life Course Research and other pertinent information therein. Then we'll unpack the center, what the structure of the Center for Life Course Research is and how it's structured, what its mission is, how it's set up, how it works, why it was developed, et cetera, et cetera. Then we'll get into the goals that the Center for Life Course Research has over the next 3 years and any areas it might be changing in. And then we'll wrap up with advice that Christina may have for those looking to do what she does or get involved in all of the areas that she is involved in. A quick bio on Dr. Chambers. She is a perinatal epidemiologist whose research is focused on environmental exposures and pregnancy and child health outcomes, including birth defects. She co-directs the Center Better Beginnings in the Department of Pediatrics at UCSD and is the program director of Mother to Baby California, which is a service providing individualized risk assessments regarding medications and other exposures for pregnant and breastfeeding women and their providers in the state of California. She is a founding principal investigator for the Vaccines and Medications in Pregnancy Surveillance Systems, the VAMPSS, which is the first national system to evaluate medication and vaccine safety in human pregnancy, and currently leads a number of nationwide studies of pregnancy outcomes following maternal exposures. She also has contributed to research on improved diagnoses, prevention, and treatment for fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Most recently, she established Mommy's Milk, a national research repository located at UC San Diego. The goal of Mommy's Milk is to collect breast milk samples from mothers who consent to participate, along with information about their infant's growth and development. This resource can be used by researchers throughout the world about the composition and benefits of human milk and whether or not medications or other exposures that the mother has transferred into her breast milk and how that may or may not affect her breastfed infant. So that's a kind of an intense bio, and I really want to drop into I'm going to read the bio for the Center for Life Course Research as we come to it, but Dr. Chambers, I would love to drop straight into your academic background and your brief professional life following that.
All right, so I've had sort of an unusual trajectory in terms of leading into academic life. So I had a career in business for many years, for about 20 years, before sort of changing career paths and deciding a direction that I wanted to go. And actually, the maybe curious thing about it is how I really got interested in it was from a volunteer experience. So I started volunteering in the neonatal intensive care unit at UC San Diego on my day off. And then I also volunteered in a counseling service, the same one, this mother to baby that was mentioned in the bio, that provides information to pregnant and breastfeeding women to help them know about or be careful about exposures they might have that could cause harm, but also to feel comfortable about ones that are likely safe. And it just hit a nerve with me that this was kind of the place in life where I wanted to be. So I, you know, went back to school, got a master's in public health, and then, you know, became pretty evident by the end of that, well, this was not enough. And so then I continued on to get a PhD in public health epidemiology. And then that led to a faculty position at UC San Diego in the Department of Pediatrics. And so I've been doing this now for the last 20 years or so, working as my home department in pediatrics, but also, as you can probably tell from the bio, what I do and what my group does actually encompasses multiple specialty areas, and particularly maternal health. And so we partner with Reproductive Health Sciences at UC San Diego and elsewhere. I'm also engaged in global health. It's doing some of this work in other countries, and also engaged with the School of Pharmacy with an appointment there as well, since many of the things that we focus on are medications.
Wonderful. And so when did you join the Center for Life Course Research when it was created in 2015 or after that?
Yes. We founded it. The Clinical Translational Research Institute, as you know from your investigation of the how CTSA sites are structured, our one at UC San Diego was already in existence, but there was a particular interest in by the PI, Gary Feierstein, in trying to encompass pediatrics as an emphasis area in our CTRI, but to make it sort of broader focused. And so it's in keeping with that theme, the idea of having a life course research center that encompassed the entire lifespan came up. And so I was asked to lead that and sort of founded that in 2015, and it's continued to expand since then.
Okay, and so for everyone listening in the audience, the Altman Clinical and Translational Research Institute, or ACTRI, we did a podcast with two of the head leader female over there, and we kind of unpacked what it was and what it does. So for anyone curious about learning more about the institute, you guys can get on and listen to that podcast. It's Tia Levine, as well as Angela Gorsman something. Anyway, but I wanted to kind of have you draw, so the ACTRI, is that the umbrella that the Center for Life Course Research is nestled under, or do they run in tandem with one another? Because I know that you utilize the ACTRI facilities for things like mommy's milk. Is that correct?
Yes. So yes, the Center for Life Course Research is under the umbrella of the ACTRI. So that's the sort of overarching infrastructure. Yeah.
Okay. And let me read a quick bio. It's taken directly from your website, but it's more well put than anything I can kind of summarize just for everyone listening. The Center for Life Course Research at UC San Diego at ACTRI was created in 2015 to incorporate special populations and all age groups into research. This integrated program is the first of its kind at UC San Diego and provides unique multidisciplinary opportunities to bring pediatricians, neonatologists, internists, family medicine physicians, and geriatric specialists together to study special populations and life course transitions. Broadly, life course research investigates the long-term effects of social, behavioral, and biologic determinants of disease across the lifespan or across generations. Through the study of biologic pathways by which these determinants operate, both independently and jointly, researchers strive to elucidate the origins and trajectories of disease. Through collaborations across multidisciplinary teams, clinical researchers seek to bridge developmental transitions throughout the life course, enabling a continuum of care and investigation into biologic plasticity, fetal programming, and critical periods of growth and development. Life course research develops and incorporates methodologies specific to analytical techniques appropriate for modeling, repeat observations, hierarchical data, latent exposures, and or multiple interactive effects. And so I understand, and the facilities at ACTRI are so massive. You know, we got into the wet lab and everything else, and having these things. But can you now unpack for us the Center for Life Course Research? Its mission, you know, we kind of just got into, is to study through a collaboration, a multidisciplinary team effect, all of these different relationships. Can you kind of maybe suss out an example or something that you're working on right now to kind of bring that more to the surface of the audience and people listening?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's become apparent over the last couple of decades. Many people are kind of familiar with the Barker hypothesis, that there are things that happened early in life or even prenatal life, such as your growth, birth weight, that seem to be pretty strong predictors of things that don't pop up or occur until 40, 50, 60 years later. So risk for diabetes or for obesity or for cardiovascular disease, that sort of trajectory may be set up very early on in life. And so that kind of lends in mind, there are a lot of people in the world who have been interested in saying, gee, you know, research tends to be done in little, small blocks of time. So that's how NIH funds research, typically in 5-year blocks of time or even shorter. And that oftentimes you're doing research on a population at a snapshot in time. So that you're really not looking at things that could have led to whatever you're looking at now in terms of a health outcome that occurred 20, 30 years ago and everything else along the way, and nor are you looking forward in terms of what you know up to that point, what that might predict in the future. So by taking this kind of life course approach, and this is, applies across all health sciences, the thinking is that you can get a much better handle on what combinations of factors and what inflection points do things head off in one direction versus another. So why is it that one person develops cancer and another doesn't? Why is it that, one person develops Alzheimer's disease and another doesn't? Where are those inflection points? And you mentioned in the bio, plasticity. So we know that there are periods in time that if you did this thing differently, that it might have changed the entire trajectory for the rest of the of your life. What is it about cognitive aging, the rapidity with which that happens, or the slowness with which that happens? What are the things that could contribute to that? And in the reality of it is that if you ideally had every piece of information about everybody you were studying from day zero to 100 years of age, that would be wonderful, but that's usually a cost barrier and time barrier. Right. To gathering this information. So there are people that have worked on developing methods to be able to kind of reconstruct the life course with pieces of it that you have available at different times. So it's a evolving methodology to be thinking about longitudinal trajectories and what happens if one thing happens at one time point versus another. But that's one of the goals of the center is to help clinical researchers to adopt and become comfortable with these methods in thinking about their research questions, not in a vacuum, but what are the combination of factors that could have contributed to what they're seeing now and what will happen in the future. And ultimately, that will help inform the best interventions, the best recommendations for how people may have better health over the trajectory of life. I think the center being located in ACTRI is perfect because, as you've heard in the previous podcast, the CTRI infrastructure is intended to be able to support clinical research by training the workforce, by providing facilities, expert assistance in biostatistics and clinical research coordinators and so on, and by helping with study design and methods, that all of those things are a goal of all of the clinical translational science awards, including the one at UC San Diego. So we fit right in with that like a glove in terms of being able to take this life course approach and applying, training of the workforce, helping people with methodology, improving skill level, and being able to design studies and interpret them. At the same time, as you think of this life course trajectory and approaches to conducting research in that way, it brings up exactly the questions that arise at, when I mentioned inflection points, there are particular transition times in life that seems to be incredibly important or vulnerable for health. And so, prenatal life and birth is a major transition time. Another one is adolescence into adulthood. Another one is in middle life until a aging population, and then end of life. And so what we have done in the Center for Life Course Research is make sure that we've involved clinical researchers at each aspect of those transition time points so that we can sort of, knit together how those all play a part along a person's lifespan. So we have a steering committee. We have the Center for Life Course Research has a structure with me serving as the director and then co-directors that involve Andrea LaCroix, who is a world-renowned specialist in women's health and aging, and we have another epidemiologist, Gretchen Vandeley, who's a specialist in early childhood and child diversity, and we have a person who's involved in middle life research as well, and then we have a group of advisors or consultants who are faculty members or students at UC San Diego who kind of follow what activities we're engaging in over the course of the year and provide us with feedback and suggestions about directions that we might pursue across the campus or across different campuses, including other CTRIs. So that includes the chair of the Department of Family Medicine and Public Health at UC San Diego, Dr. Cheryl Anderson, includes Dr. Jeannie Wong, who is a pediatric gastroenterologist who has made great strides in developing transition care programs to help children as they move into adolescence be able to begin to take responsibility for their health conditions as they move out from, parents providing guidance for them, and then transition into being able to manage their healthcare and their diseases and their treatment effectively as they move into adult care. And this is, this is recognized as a critical transition period for, health, just general health, but certainly for children who have chronic serious conditions as they move into adult care. So I sort of given you a broad overview here of what the center does. We've done part of our education mission. We've conducted some life course focused symposia. So some of them are focused on a particular exposure. So we did a very well attended one last year on cannabis across the life course. Maybe it was 2 years ago, where we looked at what's known or not known about prenatal effects of cannabis, what's known or not known about adolescent use of cannabis. We looked at it in terms of information and work that's being done here about driving under the influence. And then we looked at it in the aged, so people in geriatrics who are looking at cannabis use and health benefits and health effects. So it was sort of a all-encompassing on a specific exposure. We did a methods workshop where we had the top people in the field of life course research from the UK who have been following actually a cohort, an entire population of people born in a specific city 70 years ago. They've been following them with repeated visits all of that time. And so they did a sort of training with the audience on how that was done and what methods they developed and were able to apply there. And we've done one on successful aging or aging across the life course, because aging doesn't begin when you're 60 or 70, it begins from day one. And that brought in top researchers in aging research and epigenetics and so on to kind of look at this across the spectrum. So those are kind of some of the activities that we've engaged in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a labyrinth for me, especially thinking about it when you deal with longevity studies or life course research, as you're calling it. I wonder when you get into, you mentioned, you know, the biologic plasticity that the program has and the transitional times that you kind of set up to research and look at. I think about all of the research being done with triggers, you know, or things that are being called triggers during transitional times, the onset of adolescent diabetes, for instance, things of that nature, type 1 diabetes. Yeah. But I wonder, do you have like a framework? I feel like it's kind of like looking at the human genome 20 years ago, you know, when they captured it, everyone said, great, and we have no idea what to do with all this information.
What,
do you provide
what to do with this?
Yeah, exactly, right? It's wonderful to have. Now what do we do? It's, you know, kind of boiling it down and really getting some interesting cross-sections to kind of compare and contrast and suss out some of these more important, crucial features. You provide a framework? You were saying you've got the steering committee for structure and these advisors and consultants of staff and faculty, but do you, at the Center for the Life Course Research, do you guys provide kind of this boilerplate of how everyone's going to come at it, or is it just taken on a piece by piece, experiment by experiment, study by study basis as to what people will be analyzing, just because the factors are so major in life course research? Do you have everyone look at transition times who comes in to work with it, or how does that work?
Yeah, so it depends on your study design, but I think the kind of overarching principles and things to take into consideration, those would be common, no matter, you know, at what, you know, time point you're actually starting to capture data. But it gives you sort of a focus in terms of thinking about, well, if I'm here and I'm going to capture these data, in the planning phase, to be thinking about what are the other important things that I would want to have, knowing that I'm looking at this through this lens. So we've done this a couple of ways. One is we initiated a couple of years ago a graduate level course for clinical researchers and PhD students and so on who want to learn the general methods and an approach to doing this. And so there are it's a sort of a seminar series that has a biostatistics focus to it. So what are the analytical methods that are used, but also some example researchers who work in this area who will present on, you know, their longitudinal cohort that was looking at, you know, whatever, nutrition, and how life course research methods were applied, what were the considerations they took into place, took into account, if they had to do over again, what would they have done differently? So I think that approach has been taken. We've also disseminated or made available as a kind of training video, the talks that were given at that symposia seminar that I told you about, where the group came over from UK. Mm-hmm. So that's broken down into some sections and available for anyone who wants to actually kind of go through, a few hours of training on how to do this and what the pitfalls are or not. We also will consult on an individual basis. So if somebody has this study they're putting together, it's not only what's the study design, but the sort of general study design principles, like have you attended to these transition periods or these vulnerable periods or triggers, as you mentioned? Are you able to get the appropriate kind of representative population? Is your length of follow-up adequate for the research questions that you're trying to answer? So we can either provide ourselves or make connections with clinical researchers who need that kind of advice. If there's a special population that should be included in your study or you want to include, how do you tap into that, special population, whether it's a vulnerable population or underserved, or it's a group of people that might typically be harder to attract to participate in research. So those are all kinds of consulting services that we can provide. And then we also provide data sets, not the data sets themselves, but linkage to data sets that already exist. And that's a tremendous resource. So on our LifeCourse website within ACTRI, we're building a library. And so we have a library with links of existing longitudinal cohort studies. So these studies that have collected data over time, and it could be, it could be a study that's about asthma, or it could be a study that's about diabetes. The point is to say, here are some existing cohorts where some of them have biological samples, some of them don't, some of them cover, 10 years, some of them cover a shorter period of time. And here's the description of the data set. Here's the person who is responsible for the data set you can contact and see if you can use this. Some of them are publicly available data sets, like the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, that you can just apply to get without having to go through an investigator. So that's a resource for people who want to do secondary analysis. So sometimes it doesn't require, you have a question and it doesn't require that you go out and recruit, spend $5 million to go out and recruit new people. You actually can test your hypothesis in existing data looking at a novel question. And then we just recently added to the library biorepository samples. The first ones that went up were pediatric samples, where an investigator may have collected cerebrospinal fluid for a study, or they may have collected blood for looking at a biomarker for onset of diabetes or something like that. And if they had consented, the participants, and collected the samples appropriately to be able to use them for future uses, then with that proper ethics approval and the investigator's agreement that, I have leftover sample, I would be interested in talking to anybody who wants to collaborate, we've listed those in the library as well. So that's an opportunity for somebody who says, I want to know if this biomarker would be a good one for me to incorporate into my study. Maybe you can do some pilot work with existing data, much more efficiently and at less cost. And that pairs up investigators who might not otherwise have talked to each other or known that this resource existed.
Exactly. And it diversifies sample collection. I mean, there's so many things that shared libraries like that do. I mean, the amount of time and money therein saved is amazing. And like you're talking about, this whole new level of collaboration, bumping into an unsuspected individual at a proverbial water cooler, so to speak, and getting information.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of want to use that and transition into what you're, I'm fascinated and taken with the Mommy's Milk Project, and I'd love to know a little bit more about that. I haven't been on the wire for, knowing a lot about public health projects and things of that nature, particularly in LifeCourse research, but I don't think that there has been enough research done over like life course research and studying, you know, human breast milk and things of that nature. Can you talk about when you established Mommy's Milk and the data collection point you're at this point, and if you've started to examine different things?
Sure. So we started this in 2014, and luckily engaged the interest of ACTRI in collaborating on this as a unique resource that from a sort of an infrastructural standpoint would float the boat of a lot of research questions. So kind of going back to the beginning, here's this liquid gold, as people call it, this source of nutrition that is supposed to be the sole source of nutrition for an infant up to 6 months of age. And this is worldwide. So it's incredibly important to know something about this thing that sustains life for the first few months of life for most babies in the world. And yet, amazingly, we know very little about it. When I started to learn about this, that the idea that in talking with a nutritionist that we don't have recommended daily allowances for nutritional intake for babies under two because they're supposed to be breastfed. And we don't really know the variability in nutritional content of breast milk across the world or under different circumstances, if the mother has a chronic condition, those sorts of things. So that's kind of a basic question. Lots of mothers need to be able to express breast milk and feed the baby from a bottle. They go to work, sometime in the after delivery, and have to be able to feed their babies that way. We don't know a whole lot about the optimum conditions under which to store milk. How long can it stay frozen, and so on. And then we are also very interested in looking at what are the components in milk, in addition to the nutritional components, that just happen because you're living in the world. We've published out of this data set looking at what are the contaminants that come from fish. So, we know that, mercury and sometimes in fish is at higher levels in some types of fish. And there are reasons certainly in pregnancy that you don't want to eat high mercury containing fish because it might have a neurotoxic effect on the developing baby. But are those same types of toxins found in breast milk from mothers who consume certain types of fish or large amounts of it? And could those in turn have an impact on the baby? We're learning that there are plenty of other things in breast milk. So as you start to, you as an adult woman have had a lifetime of exposure, some of which are things that get stored in your fat or your bone, and they start to get released during pregnancy and lactation. And so are some of those things that maybe you had exposure to a pesticide, 10 years ago that got stored in fat. And as you start to release those fat cells during the breastfeeding period, is that ending up in breast milk? And does it make a difference? Does it have any impact on the baby? Me personally, because of my interest in exposures to medications and other substances, we deal with this every day, that women will say, I'm breastfeeding and my doctor tells me I have to take this antibiotic or I have to take this medication for my rheumatoid arthritis or whatever, and there, nobody's tested milk to see how much of the drug gets in there, and I'm really worried about this, so I'm going to stop breastfeeding. Or they turn around and say, I'm supposed to take my asthma medication, but I'm really worried because there's not information about how much of the drug gets into breast milk, and I don't want my baby to get any, so I'm not going to take my asthma medication. Mm-hmm. Neither of those is the optimum solution. They're both bad solutions. So, and the reason that people are making these decisions, pediatricians and women, are because they don't have the data, and the data is not that difficult to get. So that was a major reason for establishing this breast milk repository, to kind of float the boat of lots of people with different research questions around the world, and then a focus on looking at substances and medications and so on in breast milk, and then following those babies up. So we start in 2014. We cannot handle the number of people who are interested in joining. So we have about 1,600 women enrolled. They each give about 50 milliliters up to a full expression. And they can either do this here in San Diego, or we send them a kit and they collect it and send it back to us by FedEx. And they also graciously, after consent, answer a whole bunch of questions about the circumstances around breastfeeding, how long they've been doing it, how often they do it, whether they're supplementing with formula, whether the baby's getting any solid food, whether they breastfed a previous child, and all of that sort of stuff. And then a number of questions about how the baby's doing, and then a 14-day history of every medication, every vaccine, every vitamin and mineral, herbal product, alcohol, tobacco, anything that they've had exposure to over those 14 days, we capture that. And then they also fill in questionnaires about anxiety and stress. They do a food frequency questionnaire about their diet, exercise habits, and then they allow us to be able to have their doctor send us medical records, and that way we can follow the growth of the baby over time. Nice. And then we send them questionnaires about development. So they get every few months, they get a questionnaire for standard measures of developmental screening. And then for a subset, they actually get face-to-face testing. So kind of an example, one we published last year in Pediatrics was that kind of the first paper out there at all looking at the amount of THC that's measurable in breast milk from mothers who are frequent cannabis users, marijuana users. And so we were able, working with the School of Pharmacy, to show that, you know, over half of the samples that women gave us where they reported any use in the last 14 days, you could actually have detect measurable levels of THC. And of course, it was the higher the most, you know, fewer number of hours since the last use, the higher the measured level, which sort of stands to reason, and small quantities compared to what an adult would have in their bloodstream. But the question is, does that make a difference? And so now we're following up, we've expanded the sample, and we're following up those children to see, does it make a difference? You know, maybe it doesn't at all, or maybe it does at, you know, above a certain dose, but being able to know what the answer is to that question so people can be appropriately advised, we think is really important.
And what markers are you looking for? Simply growth, or which markers are you looking for? I mean, are you looking up until the age of two? And are you looking for physiological, or, I mean, are you any type of disease?
Both. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Both. For breastfed infants, there's, World Health Organization has sort of normal growth curves for boys and girls. And so we're looking at how, if a mother has a certain exposure, or she has other things we're looking at is microbiome and so on, is there some difference in that mom's child's growth trajectory compared to the child who doesn't, the mom's breast milk doesn't have those characteristics. So yes, that's one thing. And then in terms of the child health outcomes, it's not only growth, which is really strong predictor of development, but also screening on meeting developmental milestones like language development, communicative skills, motor skills. Is the child speaking words, screening for autism spectrum disorders that can be done pretty early. And then as the children get older and the follow-up, actually, women are, when they consent to enroll in the study, we say, you know, we are going to ask you to continue to be followed up with your child coming in up to about 4 to 5 years of age. But they consent for all future uses and for us to be able to recontact them if something else comes up. So the face-to-face testing, where it's actually a psychometrist who comes and tests the child and the mom, and it's more diagnostic, that's done when the children are late preschool age, so around 3 to 5.
And what's the duration of the study? So you said 6 or 3 to 5?
Yeah, so what we would like to have moms do is stay in the study from the time they enroll, and they don't have to be breastfeeding a newborn. They can be breastfeeding a child who's two. But, you know, most women enroll in the first 12 months of their child's life, but we will take them anytime. And then from that point forward, our sort of standard follow-up is between 3 and 5 years of age. And then if there was, having established the cohort, if there's reason to, or a specific question, since they've given permission for us to recontact them, it would be possible to do longer term follow-up. So kind of going back to the life course issue, yeah. Is there, would you be able to say, 10 years from now, is there an increased risk of onset of, obesity in adolescence if yep. You had, these characteristics of your breast milk?
Yeah. And I, again, the power of these studies. I mean, I think it hit me most, 25 years ago in my undergraduate career, but looking at life course research and longevity studies, it's kind of the only way we get some really powerful, ideas about time. Yeah. Is such a major factor that we don't, play into a lot. Yep. With a lot of our analysis, critical medical analysis, yep. I think. And really quickly, I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to look towards, are there any goals that Life Course Research, the Center for Life Course Research has over the next 3 years, or any areas that it's thinking about changing or diversifying in?
Yeah, we touched a little bit on vulnerable populations. I'm really that's one of the areas that we want to be able to focus on, not only inclusiveness, but ways that things might. The conclusions that you might draw from a study, as you want representativeness, but conclusions that you might draw from a study that excludes vulnerable populations because they might be difficult to enroll in this study. And if you're coming, drawing a conclusion that doesn't apply to that vulnerable population, well, what do you have? So you've lost the ability to be able to have it be generalizable to the people you would like to be able to provide that to. So that's an area that we want to focus on. And one of our kind of advisors is to that end is a medical student who's doing an MD-PhD program here at UCSD, who's Native American and very, very, very passionate about policy as it relates to health and health research in that population. And traditionally, for many good reasons, have had barriers to wanting to engage in clinical research, clinical trials to everything else. So we think that that's an opportunity area for us that we can make a difference. Certainly in San Diego. And here, San Diego has a very diverse population, but are there vulnerable populations that are just not being included in research because it's more difficult, right. Because there are barriers that we haven't addressed?
Absolutely. I like the idea of, of getting into vulnerable populations for a perspective in general, but I think it's a good goal too, especially given that you've got so much data coming in on things like mommy's milk. Yeah. I know that if someone's looking to kind of study what you're doing or get involved in some of these things, either as a participant or just research, they can contact the Center for Life Course Research or ACTRI and kind of suss out, Dr. Christina Chambers and contact her that way. However, I'm looking for, if you ran into a young female or female identified individual and who said, listen, I just got done doing, some volunteer work. I think I'm going to head in to get a master's in public health. I'm really taken with these populations of the infant neonatal care unit that I've been doing. What are the top three pieces of advice you would give her moving forward in her future path?
Yeah, so I love talking to people that are at that point in their life. And I guess I like to tell my story because it's not a traditional pathway. And I think, it's when you're thinking of your, career path, it's not, career path, this is a life course you know, message in and of itself. Career path doesn't sit in isolation, you know, it's everything else that's going on in your life and what you're postponing in order to choose this way of going. And, you know, things that come up and hit you in the face that you didn't expect were going to happen. So I think that you take somebody, you know, especially a young person who's making those decisions about career path, I say it's an incredibly exciting area. And if you have the passion for it, you know, go forward. At recognizing, I think it's important to keep in mind that it's never all she wrote. So what you think is your plan this month, that 2 years from now could go a completely different direction. And that you, the best thing I think you can do is to be open to opportunities as they arise. You don't want to get, you know, scattered, but to be thinking of kind of where your opportunities lead you in a direction that feels right and consistent with what you want to do, and also recognizing that you're going to be diverted along the path one way or another. That's going to happen. And I guess the second thing would be look to who you admire. And so if you think this is something you would like to do, find somebody or two people or three people that you may know or not know who you think have kind of reached the peak or epitome of what you would like to be, and then look at what it took for them to get to that point. And it's not always that you have to go the pathway of, oh, you know, you have to do this by this time, this by this time, and this by this time in order to be winning the Nobel Prize by the time you're, you know, 50. It could, there's many pathways to get to a way where you can make a difference and be fulfilled in your career. And that's, you know, having the creative openness to that, I think, is important for anyone kind of embarking on a career in public health.
Absolutely. So we've got career path does not sit in isolation. If you have passion, go forward, be amiable to change, and look to who you admire. And not all career paths are the same. I was in Stockholm, Sweden, a couple of months ago, which is the birthplace of the Nobel Prize. Alfred Nobel established it there. And I went to the Nobel Prize Museum, and they gave my six-year-old a Nobel Prize made of chocolate for finding all of the hidden gems in the museum. So there's another route to go if one's looking for a Nobel, and it seems unattainable in this lifetime. There's a chocolate one waiting for you in Stockholm.
I love it.
I want to say thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking this hour out of your day. I know that you are so busy, and it's a, you know, you are in a very intricate and beautiful web of deep knowledge and information, and I applaud you for dealing with my very novice and naive introspection into what you're doing.
Not at all. No, I appreciate your questions and you're taking an interest in this and being and taking the dive to go in and look at it closely. So I appreciate that opportunity.
Absolutely. I believe there's a lot of shared pathways and bridges between entrepreneurship and female founders and what's happening with everything, you know, at the Center for Life Course Research. So everyone who's thinking that you've got something that could be in tandem, jump online at, you can go through ACTRI in San Diego or the Center for Life Course Research at UC San Diego and get all of the information you need there. Thank you once again, Dr. Chambers, and I hope to coerce you in talking to me again sometime in a future podcast.
Sure. All right. I look forward to it.
Thank you. And for everyone listening, thank you for giving me your time. And until we speak again, remember to always bet on yourself. Sláinte.